Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb. Episode 119 for May 3rd, 2010. The Mars Rover Drivers. Floss Weekly is brought to you by Drobo, the original S, Pro, and New Elite, offering expandable storage products for individuals, small businesses, and creative teams. For more information and instant rebates, visit drobo.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show weekly covering free Libre open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, here with you again today to bring you some very interesting guests. I believe it'll be one of our most interesting shows we've ever had, but we'll wait and see. Co-hosting with me this week is Aaron Newcomb. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, Randall. How's it going?
Doing well. Doing well now. We've seen you on this show before, haven't we?
Yeah, I've been a guest a couple times talking about ZFS, and then I was on again talking about Cinelera, which is the video editor that I use to make my podcast, my video podcast. So yeah, I've been on a few times, and you know, I kind of do this as a hobby on the side. I'm a Linux and open source enthusiast, so yeah, I'm glad to join you today.
Great, cool. And not only do we have a new time slot, where if you're watching this live or want to watch this live, it's now 9:30 a.m. on Pacific time, and you'll have to do all the math to figure out whenever it is. It's on Wednesday still, just like it was before. But because of the time slot, of course, we had to lose John O'Bacon, a really great co-host for a long time. So I'm testing out a few new co-hosts, so we'll see. This is kind of an audition, Aaron. I hope you're not nervous, right?
No. I do this enough, both in my work life and on the side, that it comes pretty natural to me at this point.
Okay, good. Well, I'm sure you'll do great. Hey, also just to bring up some stuff about last couple of shows, we interviewed Sean Pierce last week for the Garrett code review system. Are you familiar with that, Aaron?
Yeah, I was actually listening about halfway through that podcast right now, so don't give it all away. I'm enjoying listening to it.
Well, what's great is my client here, where I'm actually taping the show today, needed a Git repo. So we actually installed Garrett yesterday, and Sean was actually in the IRC chat room the whole day giving me tech support. That was a pretty good debate. Not often. It'd be like having Guido von Rossum, you know, sitting there while you're trying to install Python or something. It was really kind of cool. So I just wanted to say that. And also, just to cover up a couple of shows ago, did you hear the Bob Jacobson show, Aaron?
I missed that one, but I've heard actually on Twitter people talking about it. So it seemed like a good show.
Yeah, well, not only that, but I did want to follow up on that as well, because I did make a call to action at the end of that to have people donate to his cause, because he's minus about $30,000 based on all his legal costs. And I'm happy to report, I just got this note a few minutes ago from him. I'll read this to you literally. There's been a great response. Just short of 250 people donated. The total was almost $3,500. Lots of $1, $5, and $10 donations, a few much higher, and many of them carried very supportive comments, which I appreciated a lot. So I just want to pass it along to you guys out there who made a difference at making this all work. So just wanted to bring that along. Let's get into today's show, because that's really what's important now. I need to set the stage a little bit of this. Eric, go ahead and call him back now. I'll stop for a second. We can break here.
Okay.
So let me know when Aaron's back. And darn it, I did forget to put the call to action at the end. Oh, well.
Hey, is that better?
I hear you fine. I can't see you, but I hear you.
Yes, I think it's better.
Okay, great.
I'm here.
So let's stop talking about the past few shows, because we have a great show coming up today. This is going to be interesting, but I want to set up actually how it happened. I was on a cruise back in December for Insight Cruises, and on board was Jim Bell. He's one of the scientist that's working on the Mars Rover project. You know, you're familiar with the rovers, right? The little things are driving around on Mars, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so Jim Bell is actually the guy that is the lead scientist for the Pan Cam, the panoramic camera that they have in there. And he had some beautiful pictures he was taking from there. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, you know, did they use any open source software in the Mars project? Because I do this little podcast called Floss Weekly, and I'd love to interview somebody about that. And he says, everything is open source. It's all open source. Everything, it's just crazy that way. So I said, can you get me an introduction? And so I sent a note off to him, and he got me in touch with today's guests. We have none other than Scott Maxwell. He is the lead Mars rover driver. That's his job every day. It's an out-of-this-world job. He gets to drive the rover around every day, or both rovers, I think, actually. So, and we also have one of his teammates, Paolo Belluta. So we've got them on today. Should be a pretty interesting show. I'm really looking forward to this. It should be a really, really fun thing. How's it sound there, Aaron?
Oh, it sounds great. I can't wait to talk to him.
But before we do that, I also am very excited that today's show actually has a sponsor. I love shows with sponsors. This is great. We have none other than Drobo. And do you have a Drobo? Have you seen Drobos?
You know what? I've seen them. I love them. I recommend them. I built my own Drobo. But for consumers, boy, they're great products.
Absolutely. So just to let you know, this episode is brought to you by the expanding line of Drobo storage products. And I've owned a Drobo for a year and a half now, I think, ever since it was a special on MacBreak Weekly or something like that. But it's basically a digital storage device that's automated and intelligent. It combines multiple hard disks into a single drive of storage, and it's accessible right from your desktop. And Drobos are made by Data Robotics, and recently they have two new storage devices, the Drobo S and the Drobo Elite. And that brings the model count now down up to four different Drobos for different storage needs, different types of users. Drobos are designed for individuals like me, small businesses, I guess it also includes me, creative professionals, well, that's definitely not me, and teams of creative professionals. And three of the four Drobo models connect right to your desktop or to a single computer. The original Drobo, which is the one I have, has four disk bays, great for home users to store your iTunes library, music, movies, photo collection, family videos. I use mine to back up my entire laptop every day to a bootable drive, so all my data gets stored every day on my Drobo. And there's a newer Drobo S that has five disk bays, higher performance for creative professionals, and the Drobo Pro for small businesses, creative teams with eight disk bays. Now, the newest model they just added is the Drobo Elite. It has eight disk bays as well, but it's different because it's network storage, a storage area network, and supports up to 16 computer connections. So the network connections are 2 gigabit Ethernet ports for connecting to hosts using iSCSI. So it makes the Drobo Elite look and perform like a local disk drive. Drobo Elite is good for small businesses, video editing teams who want the benefits of storing and accessing files on a network. Drobo Elite, of course, is VMware certified. So learn more about the Drobo by going to drobo.com/floss. Drobo.com/floss, and you'll find special discounts on combinations because you follow that URL. Now, let's get back and go talk to our guests. What do you think, Aaron?
That sounds great. I can't wait.
Here we go. It's my absolute treat, my pleasure, to be welcoming today's guests. First, let's go to Scott Maxwell. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Randall. Nice to be here with you. Nice to see you.
Such a privilege. And of course, let's not leave out Paolo Belluta, also joining us today.
Nice to meet you.
And where are we speaking to you, Scott? Where are you at right now?
I am in Washington University in St. Louis right now. I'm out here on a visit.
Oh, so they let you escape Pasadena every once in a while?
Every once in a great while, yeah. That's often cool. But now and then.
But still holding down the home fort. Paolo, you're in Pasadena right now, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
I'm just down the street here in LA. So if I wave, can you see me? Can you see me?
No, actually, I'm in a basement, so I don't see anything else besides the walls.
Okay. See, this is why it's okay for me to leave. I can chain Paolo up in the basement once in a while, and he runs everything for me, and then it's okay.
That's pretty amazing. Well, you guys have what's got to be one of the best jobs in the world, and I'm sure you hear that all the time. But
we have the best job on two planets, as a matter of fact.
That's great. That's great. So Scott, I just wanted to ask you, do you drive little RC cars at home too?
No, I do all my rover driving on Mars only. I'm not so much of a car fan. Paolo is more of a car fan than I am.
And so Paolo, you drive little cars?
My son is mostly a car fan. I'm just following him.
So I want to start by sort of getting the typical day for you guys, because I know that, you know, there's there's a lot of work involved, and I've seen some descriptions of this. I watched a video that you pointed me out up on YouTube there. And so starting with Scott, why don't you describe what a typical day is like doing your day job?
Well, typically, you know, what we would like to do is we would like to drive the Rovers like RC cars, like you were talking about. We'd like it if we had a joystick and we could just, you know, push forward on the joystick and the Rover would go, and then we'd let go of the joystick and the Rover would stop, that kind of thing. And the reason that we can't do that, of course, is because of light time delays. So because Mars is so far away from Earth, it can take several minutes for a radio signal to get there. When Mars and Earth are on the same side of the planet, it's about 4 minutes each way. And when they're on the same side of the sun, I should say, it's about 4 minutes each way. When they're on, the two planets are on opposite sides of the sun, it can be up to 20 minutes each way. So if you push forward on that joystick, then nothing happens for between 4 and 20 minutes. And then you don't know what happened because you don't get the return signal for another 4 to 20 minutes. So if you just imagine trying to back your car out of that driveway, out of the driveway, where you step on the gas and your car doesn't start moving for another, let's say, 4 minutes, and you don't know what happened when your car started moving because your windshield doesn't update for another 4 minutes, you can see why we don't try to drive around Mars that way. Even if you had no other traffic on the road, it would take you you would have a very hard time driving to work safely. So instead, what we do is this. We basically work the Martian night shift. We take advantage of the fact that the rovers are solar powered and they have to shut down for the Martian night anyway. And as the sun is going down in the Martian sky, they send us back pictures and other data that tell us about the world around them. And we take all the pictures and data they send us back, and we make a 3D simulation that runs in a simulator on our Linux workstations. And then we can drive a rover around within that Linux workstation. We can send it commands, you know, drive forward so far, turn this much, that kind of thing. Put together a whole list of those things. And when we get the simulator doing what we like, we review it several times with the rest of the team. And if everybody likes everything that's in the simulation, then we cross our fingers. Well, we don't really cross our fingers, and we send that up to Mars. And then the rover spends its entire day clocking out that drive that we put together. And so, you know, basically at that point, we go home and go to sleep while the rover is working. And then the rover kind of clocks out through its whole day. And then at the end of the day, when the sun's going down, it sends us back more pictures and more data telling us what it actually did. And the whole cycle repeats.
So it's never moving at Martian night then. So that's the time that it's just sitting there. That's the time you're working because you're trying to figure out what to do the next day. How much of the day is spent moving?
The rovers will spend, I think our absolute all-time record is in the neighborhood of 5 or 6 hours of driving during the day. But typically it's much less than that. Typically it's maybe an hour to 2 hours.
And it's not very fast, right? So it's pretty slow, like maybe what, a foot a second, or not a foot a second, but like slower than that?
A few centimeters per second, yeah. The rovers weigh about as much as a motorcycle, but they only have as much power. Even when the solar panels are perfectly clean, because they're farther away from the sun than we are here, they don't get very much energy. So they only get about enough energy to run a couple of ordinary kitchen light bulbs. And so if you imagine trying to drive a motorcycle with only enough energy to power a couple of light bulbs, you can imagine it's not going to go very fast. But on the other hand, they're also very strong. So the even though they have a great deal of torque and they can do a very good job of articulating their suspension, kind of pulling themselves over rocks and other obstacles in their path.
Wow. So Paola, you do roughly the same job as Scott? Do you work for Scott and you're Scott? How does that work out?
Scott is my boss.
Oh, okay.
And yes, I do pretty much the same job as Scott. In the morning we come in and we see the data that the rovers are returned, and we analyze the data and decide what to do next. We try to work with the science team members and decide where it is safe to go and which route to take and which rocks to analyze and basically which features to analyze on Mars.
Now, I understand, Paola, that most of the time the rover does what you told it to do. What's the most unusual thing that came back that didn't work the way you expected?
Oh, there have been plenty of things that haven't gone wrong. Probably I would say the most embarrassing moment is that the rover one day drove in the opposite direction that we expected. Mm-hmm. We can command the rover in several different ways. One of them is by telling the rover the location, a waypoint to go to. And the rover decides whether to drive forwards or backwards, depending on which direction is closest. On that day, we also restricted the way that the rover could reach that waypoint. And for several technical details that I'm not going to into, the rover drove backwards instead of forwards. So instead of driving 20 meters forward, so it drove 20 meters backwards. It was quite a yep.
Wow. So you drove it the wrong way. That was so. What else? Now I understand that there's sort of a, you can kind of give it sort of autonomous commands in the sense that you say, like you said, where you want to get there and it kind of looks at the rocks ahead of it slowly and figures out where it's going? Or do you always have to specify every little dot to get from here to there?
We can use different ways of asking the rover to drive. We can go all the way down to the bare metal and tell the rover to apply a certain voltage to a certain motor. Mm-hmm. But we can go at a very high level and just tell the rover, well, you need to go 20 meters forward. And if there are obstacles or if you're going to slip too much, just take care of that problem yourself. And that is a pretty advanced modality to use on another planet. There are plenty of rovers that do that on the surface of Earth, where you can go and reboot them if you need them. But you cannot really do that on Mars, and you cannot really call AAA to get you out of a bad spot. So you need to be careful, and the rover needs to be careful in not getting into a bad spot in a dangerous situation.
One of the most amazing things about that, if I can just add to what Paolo was saying, is that all of the work that it takes to do that, not only the path planning, but also the much more advanced work of the 3D, basically taking the images and building up a 3D world and reasoning about that world and so on, is all done on a 20 megahertz CPU. So that's, 1/100th as fast as a machine. If you go down to your local big box retailer and buy a machine off the rack, that's probably 100 times faster than the ones that's running on board the rovers. And not only do they have to do all the other work of communicating with Earth and, making sure that they're not getting too cold and all this kind of stuff, but also all that visual processing and so on, all the stuff is running on a single 20 megahertz CPU. It's really amazing what the flight software guys did with those rovers.
Now, is it running on a 20 megahertz CPU just because that was the design at the time this design started, or is it just that was you're trying to be power efficient?
It's driven by a number of considerations. One of them is that this is a CPU that had been used in space before, and MIR was already doing several new things, and this is not a place where we particularly wanted to innovate. This is also using an older kind of radiation hardened part with bigger, chunkier transistors, so it's a little bit more a little bit less susceptible to the high radiation environment on Mars.
Are you you're not running Linux on it, are you?
No, we are running a Unix variant though. It's a commercial one, VxWorks.
Wow, that's interesting. Why a commercial thing and not open source?
Again, this is a place where I think MIR didn't particularly feel like they wanted to innovate. VxWorks is something that we had a good relationship with the company that makes it. This is the software that had been used previously on Mars Pathfinder, and so it was kind of a known quantity for the people who were designing, kind of going on from Pathfinder to design the software for this rover as well. For any space mission, there's a certain amount of kind of uncertainty budget or like novelty budget that you have that you want to spend. And MIR was already doing a lot of that and doing the stuff that Paolo was talking about. Just having autonomous path planning and a rover on Mars was a really big deal at the time. This is something that had never been done before. And so so we were kind of willing to spend our risk budget there and not so much willing to spend our risk budget in certain other areas.
Definitely. Hey, so besides the two of you, how many other people participate in the driver team?
Altogether, we had about 20 people, but at the moment, I believe it's about a dozen people.
Now, since Spirit's not moving anymore, does that mean you had to lay off a couple people, or how does that work?
I would not go so far as to say that Spirit is not moving anymore. Spirit is not moving at the moment. But Spirit will be moving again, and Paolo and I and the other rover drivers plan to get her out of Troy when we resume commandability later this year.
Has it woken back up after the dark yet? I know it was you lost contact with it for a while, right?
That's correct. And we still don't have contact with Spirit, but we expect to hear from her again in September, plus or minus a month. And in the meantime, to answer the other question you were asking, there are fewer shifts to go around than there were. Because we have the same number of drivers and only half as many rovers to drive right at the moment. So we're getting a little less practice than we're used to. But I'm hoping very much that situation will rectify itself. 6 months or so from now.
Do you have any women on the team?
Several. We have Ashley Stroop is one of the rover drivers, and Julie Townsend is our other fully qualified rover driver. And Tara Esselin is our third fully qualified rover driver. And we have another in the pipeline, Vandy Burma.
I was going to make a joke about driving and getting Spirit stuck and women, but I'm just going to avoid that joke entirely. So.
That's probably a good plan, especially if you've met any of Ashley, Tara, Vandy, or Julie.
I know. Okay, one other sort of pop culture question. Where were you on November 17, 2008, and were you watching Big Bang Theory?
I have not, I have still not seen that episode. Paolo, have you seen it by any chance?
Marco showed me a piece of it because he said that I should have watched it.
We actually have a MERV video library with various clips of the rovers on news programs and things like that. And it's in there, and I just haven't gotten around to seeing it myself yet. I have no excuse.
It's a good show. Actually, Big Bang Theory in general is a good show. When I saw that, I was sort of chuckling at the whole idea. For those of you in the audience who haven't watched that, Howard, one of the main characters, was trying to impress his girlfriend, Stephanie. And so he let her drive the Mars rover, and they ended up getting it into a ditch. And to cover their tracks, they had to erase all the tapes of everything the mission had done. So that was it was a very scary episode.
It's not based on reality, I can tell you that much.
Well, it just seemed like they were doing it in real time. That's part of the reason I said, I can't possibly be it. So now, the Mars Day is pretty close to Earth Day, but it's slightly longer, right?
That's exactly right. So the Martian Day is about 40 minutes longer than the Earth Day, and that plays into how we go about driving the rovers. So not only is there this light time delay that we were talking about earlier, but also... In fact, the Martian Day is 40 minutes longer, has some implications on when the rover is going to be able to do its work. So the rover doesn't care about when the sun is up in the Earth sky. The rover cares about when the sun is up in the Martian sky where it is. And so basically it works on a day that's 40 minutes longer every day. And back in the nominal mission, we really took advantage of this by working here on Earth on Mars time. So we set our, basically tried to make our body clocks not go by the Earth clock, but by the Mars clock. So if you got up to go to work one day at 8 o'clock, the next day you would get up to go to work at 8:40, and the next day you would get up at 9:20, and then at 10 o'clock, and then pretty soon you're getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I loved it, and it was awesome. But a lot of people really did not like living on Mars time, and that pretty much only went through the nominal mission. We went through the first 80 sols or so doing that. That a sol is a Martian day, and then resumed Earth time so that people like Paolo could see their kids.
I understand some of you even had special wristwatches that had the Mars time on it.
Yeah, I didn't have one of those, but there was a local jeweler who actually made us, we paid for him, but he figured out how to take wristwatches and like slow the workings down so that they would actually go at Mars speed. So people actually would wear wristwatches that would tell you what the time was, where the rover was. They didn't care about what the time was when, here on Earth. And that makes a lot of sense because when you're living on Mars time, you really care about the rovers in that particular way. You care about, what their time is.
So let me ask, guys, getting back to the software and what's running on the rover itself, I mean, this is something we can all download and build ourselves, right? If we want to go out and build a rover, we can go download the software and build our own robots and run them around our backyards, right? I mean, I know you guys are somewhat regulated by the government, so to speak, in what you can make publicly available, right? I mean, how available is the software or the bits and the bytes? Can anybody grab them at all, or is it pretty much locked down?
Go ahead, Paolo.
The flight software is ITAR protected, so we cannot publish any portion of the software. But we do use open source tools on the ground to analyze the data and to make our job easier.
Yeah, I thought I would to add to that, that ITAR is the International Trafficking in Arms Regulations. Technically, under the law, the rovers are weapon systems. You know, they're on Mars. They're not going to hurt anybody. But under the law, that's what they are. So we can't give you the source code that runs on board the rovers any more than we could give you the source code that runs on board an ICBM. We'd end up in jail for it, even though the threat to you is much greater from one than from the other. However, in addition to what Paula was saying about the fact that we use a lot of open source in our ground tools, also I thought I would mention that that all the pictures that come back from the rovers, all the data that comes back from the rovers goes up on the websites, usually within hours of its receipt. So anybody who wants to can see the latest pictures from the rovers, sometimes even before Paula and I see them, at marsrovers.jpl.nasa.gov.
Wow, great. And then, in terms of you were saying about your, you know, the kind of software you use on the ground. I mean, as far as the 3D modeling goes, and all of that stuff, do you have to build all that from scratch, or are you borrowing that from some open source projects or proprietary projects even?
It's kind of a mix. A lot of the software we run on the ground is stuff that we have written using Perl, using Python, using the Corn Shell, things like that that are open source. And I mentioned earlier that the workstations that we do most of our processing on are Linux workstations. So we built some things in terms of you know, on top of existing open source tools, and other things are, you know, are entirely custom. I don't think we have a whole lot of tools that are entirely proprietary. That is, that are built exclusively with proprietary products. But most things have kind of a mix. Have kind of a mix of open and you know, basically custom crafted solutions on top of running on top of open source products is a great deal of what we do. I know that we also have some of the ground software, some of the ground software processing that runs only on board Sun workstations. And Paolo can speak to the downlink section of that much more knowledgeably than I can. As far as the uplink section goes, the 3D modeling stuff that you were asking about was built on top of SGI's Open Performer software, writing a new version that's on top of Open Inventor, which is an open source version of something very similar. And that one's also using the Qt library and a whole bunch more. It's kind of being a little more aggressive about using open source products than earlier versions were.
All right, that's awesome. Just because I'm I got to ask one more question. Just because I'm a storage guy in my professional life here, what do you guys do for storage to store all these images and data that you're collecting? I mean, you talked about the processor, kind of lightweight processor that you could be used to transmit all this information. But what about storing all the data? How do you do that?
I know that we have a few Sun racks that basically give us basically a big NFS server for us. And the other way that we try to store the images is on other people's hard drives all over the world, which is why we let you download them and store them on your own machines.
Great. Awesome.
I think it's pretty amazing because you just, you know, I had to do a little happy dance here. You couldn't see me because I was off screen, but did a happy dance because you said there's some Perl code in there since I have.
Oh, a great deal. I every time I have a problem, my first recourse is a Perl script. And in fact, one of the most important Perl scripts on the mission is one that I wrote and maintain to basically automate the checking of flight rules. So every day, you know, part of the process is taking this collection of things that we know we shouldn't do, sometimes because we thought of it in advance of making a mistake, and sometimes because we made the mistake and realized, you know, let's not do that again. And it goes through the sequences that we're thinking about sending to the rovers and make sure that we're not going to make that same mistake a second time. And that thing is basically one big fat Perl script that applies a whole bunch of different rules to kind of check for, you know, are you making this mistake? You're making this mistake. You're making this mistake. That's been a lifesaver for us. I really don't know how we would get along without it.
That's really great to hear that Perl is mission critical on a mission.
Yeah, it is.
Definitely. It is probably one of the most important tools that we have. Without it, probably we would have managed to make quite a few mistakes that would have been fatal to the rover.
Yeah, or we would just try to do a lot less, because we would have to, you know, try to keep things so much simpler in order to basically be able to do all that work that Perl is doing for us inside of our brains instead. Paulo, I think you might be able to speak too to some of the places where Perl is used in a lot of the downlink processing tools. I know there's a whole bunch of, you know, Mark Mamone's got a whole bunch of Perl scripts and so on over there. You want to talk about that some?
Before I wanted to talk about the storage.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
We do when we collect the data on Mars, so we store the data to flash it to a local flash drive. On the rover, that is about 256 megabytes of storage, so it's not much. But now we managed to fit some data, and we need to prioritize the data that we get to downlink from the rover. We cannot get much data every day, so we need to prioritize which images, which science data we get to download on each day. Once the data is received on the ground, we use three ground stations, one in Canberra, Australia, one in Madrid, Spain, and one here in California near Goldstone. And these three stations receive the data from Mars, and we store them on several servers here at JPL. If I'm not mistaken, so far we have collected about 10 or 12 terabytes of data from Mars. So that's how much data we transferred from Mars. Wow. Regarding Perl, as Scott was saying, Mark Mamone, which was one of the flash software developers, prepared a set of tools to analyze the data that we received from Mars. And that suite is entirely written in Perl. And uses several other open source tools like, well, of course, SET, Awk, XGraph, if anyone remembers XGraph, Gnuplot. And we use other tools to look at the images, to do animations, XNM, WorldGIF, these type of things. And, of course, the ubiquitous NetPBM and XV.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of interesting software being used. That I don't know how long you guys have been at JPL, but I know you know the reason I'm happy to answer about Perl there is that Perl was created at JPL by Larry Wall,
right.
20 years ago almost. So, I remember him telling me that the reason that pack and unpack were added was because of bit slippage on one of the downlinks. They needed to like do a bit shift of one bit or two bits slid over. So the reason pack and unpack are in there, I think it was it Mariner that went to past Saturn. Or the first one was that went past Saturn.
Not sure which mission first went past Saturn. You don't happen to know, do you, Paula?
No, I don't.
The first one that I know of that went past Saturn is the Voyager missions, but I'm not sure that they were the first ones who that actually did it.
Okay, yeah, but it's funny because pack and unpack are in there specifically for one of the JPL missions, so that was pretty cool.
How about that? And you'll be happy to hear, Randall, that in quite a few of the Perl scripts I've written, there you'll find Schwarzian transforms here and there where I'm sorting things. So,
woo-hoo! All right. So a little bit of me is helping the space program.
As a matter of fact,
real. Hey, I lost my notes. Hold on a second here. I'm just so stunned. This has just been a privilege.
You know, one of the things that's cool, Randall, is the way that you feel about talking to us is the way that we feel about talking to the rovers every day. Like, I come into work, I can't believe this is my job. I get to work with great people like Paulo. I get to work with, I get to actually like drive a Mars rover around, and then I get to go home, and I have the same reaction to it. Like, holy smoke, I got to do that again. That's awesome. So,
How long there now I'm collecting my thoughts. How long before they actually launched the probes did you get involved in the program? I mean, how much prepping was there ahead of the actual launch?
We launched in 2000. So my own story. We launched in 2000, middle of 2003, and I got involved at the end of 99 for what was actually supposed to be a different mission. When I first got involved in this, the idea was that we were going to refly basically a flight spare called Marie Curie for the rover that had gone on Mars Pathfinder. So they were basically going to do that all over again. So you remember the Pathfinder rover? It's about the size of a microwave. It's got six wheels on it, the same kind of suspension that the MER rovers have, just a lot smaller. And this is the first time they'd ever sent a rover to Mars, and they were basically going to like do that again. And long story short, JPL ended up replanning its whole Mars program. And that software that I was originally writing for that purpose got repurposed for what became MER. So MER itself came along, what, middle of 2000, something like that. So it's about 3 years later that we actually launched. Incidentally, I came to MER because I was looking for a change in my job, change in things that I was doing at JPL right after writing a book about Linux.
Oh, cool.
Incidentally. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Paolo, your story is similar?
My story is a little bit different. I joined MER. I joined JPL about 10 years ago, but I joined MER in 2004. So while the mission was already on the surface and they needed people to analyze data, because the rovers were built too well and they lasted too much. So they were scrambling for people to continue the mission, since the people that were working needed to move on and prepare the next mission. So they were hiring, and I said, of course, I want to be on this mission. I will die for it. And I joined about 6 years ago, and I haven't left the mission since then.
I understand you actually had to write some of the software for the rover after the rover had launched, and you shipped it while it was en route?
That is correct. As a side problem in the infinite wisdom, the people that now develop the fly software allocated only 3 digits to the SOL number. Each command has associated a timestamp when it needs to be executed, and needs to be executed on a particular day or SOL on Mars. So after many years on Mars, we were getting close to SOL 999, so we needed to update the fly software. And since this allocation of 3 digits only were pervasive on the entire software, we needed to basically rebuild the entire software with this change. And we included additional intelligence to the fly software. Now we can try to ask the rover to observe clouds on Mars and dust devils automatically. And
so you had your own version of the Y2K problem then?
Yes, exactly. And so since we needed to upload the new software on Mars, it took about a year to develop and test and about 3 months to upload it.
We had similar problems in the ground tools, and we just kind of went through something where we the rovers, we had told them what the absolute latest possible time was that any command could ever be sent to them. It was ridiculously late, and nobody believed that we would ever be sending commands to them past this time. And that time was the beginning of 2010, so we actually had to have another flight software update to tell the rovers, no, you've lived longer than the absolute latest possible time we thought you could live. Here's like another flight software update to get you another 10 years or so of life.
Now, when you set this up, did you have a sense it was going to last longer than the 90 days?
We all believed that the rovers were going to last their 90 days, we hoped they were going to last their 90 days that they were designed for. But nobody really thought they were going to last a whole lot longer than that. A few people who were really optimists thought the rovers might last, might double that 90-day lifespan. A very few people thought that the rovers might make it through their first winter. And if they made it through the first winter, they might make it for, you know, a little bit longer than that. But nobody, if we had had a pool, nobody was going to pick 6+ years and counting for the two rovers. So there was just no way that anybody thought they were going to go anywhere near this long. Not that we're complaining and I want them to go on a lot longer, but no, this is way beyond what we thought we were going to get. One of the crazy things about this is, one of the people who's working with us, Paul, you know, Jamie Ketchin, actually was in high school when we launched. And she finished high school, went to college, got her degree in engineering, and then came to Mars, came to the Mars Project to work on the Mars Exploration Rovers all during our mission. And my fervent hope is that Jamie's grandchildren will be joining us one of these days.
How does that affect your funding, though? I mean, is that an issue at all, or are you guys all set for funding? No worries.
Well, there's kind of good news and bad news as far as that goes. Most of the money that goes into a mission goes into design, building the mission, launching it. Launch costs alone are $100 million per rover. And then flying it to Mars. Once you actually get there, operating it is the cheap part. So even though it took something like $800 million to get us through that first 90 sols, after that, we've been operating at something under, you know, something in the neighborhood of $20 million per year. It's actually been a little less year to year. We recently got our next extended mission funding, and that funding is not quite what we would like it to be. It's not as much as I personally would like to have in order to see the rovers driven properly. So that's kind of a shame as far as I'm concerned. But you know, the cool part about it is on a sol per sol basis, even if you kind of fund us sustainably as time goes by, the rovers actually get cheaper to operate, you know, per unit of science return. So they continue to be a good investment. They just get better and better and better.
Right, right. And one of the things that I think maybe affects this as well is that one of the interesting things about this mission, at least that I'm aware of, is that you guys are very public. Like you say, all the pictures go live on the website.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of interaction with the public around this particular project. That certainly must help. And to go along with that as well, I'm kind of curious, I mean, what are your plans for the future? Are there any plans to open this up even further? You know, will the rovers have, or do they have their own Twitter handles and Twitter streams? I mean, what are your plans for opening this up and making it even more public in the future?
There is an official MER Twitter account at it's just Mars Rovers. I'm Mars Rover driver, and Paulo doesn't use Twitter very much. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to get him into it. But you're right that you know, one of the great things about the rovers, even before they were so long lived. Was the fact that we were so open and that we tried to make sure that that everybody in the world had access to the rover images, very, you know, right about the time that we do, a whole culture kind of sprung up around them, and there's websites. One place where Paulo is very active is on unmannedspaceflight.com, and other sites like that that talk about the rovers every day, so you can kind of go there and hang out with people who are talking about it.
It's just really been a treat to talk to you guys today. I could go on for hours asking you questions, but I know that we're getting close to the end of the time that I had available to chat with you guys. Is there any last thing that you want to give our audience, like a call to action for, you know, write your congressman and tell them to fund NASA better or something like that?
I'm not sure I quite want to recommend that, although I will say it's probably a good idea for all citizens to get involved and express their opinions about how they think Congress should be spending its money. And, you know, we're trying to make sure that we're, you know, for the price of a Mars bar per year, that we're bringing you another planet, that we're bringing you Mars. Paula, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I must rather not steer the path and sleeping dogs lie.
Sorry for putting you guys on the spot. That I forgot that there's some limitations to what you can say and can't say. Well, I can say it's the host, but I would encourage you
to say that, Randall. I would encourage you to speak your mind, Randall.
I will definitely do that after you guys are gone, so you don't have to be any part of it. It's fine. I'm thrilled to be chatting with you guys today. Thanks for coming on the show, and I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy Mars day to do that. And thanks for being around.
Oh, it's great talking to you. Thanks so much for having us on.
Great. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Paolo. I guess Paolo's already gone. So thank you very much, guys.
I'm still here. Just as a treat, I wanted to show a little bit of the open source in live mode. This is directly from the Mars rover data. And
oh, okay.
At the bottom of the screen, we use, for example, this is a GNU plot to look at the telemetry at the data. In this case, is the data from the wheels. And here on up, wrong window, this one is XV. Looking at one of the latest images with the arm that we use to analyze the terrain Here you can mm-hmm. see the drill that we use, the flange that is on top, which senses the contact on the surface, the tracks that we leave on Mars. And this is one of the latest images has been captured over the weekend.
And wow, Paul's not really one to toot his own horn, but all those like cool graphs and stuff you saw there that probably don't mean a whole lot to you, but mean a whole lot to us. That all comes out of a script that Paulo wrote that you know takes a whole bunch of data from the rovers and pumps it through GNUplot and other tools and automatically dumps it onto a web page for us all to analyze. And all this kind of stuff happens because you know we're able to very quickly build solutions to our problems using open source tools and open protocols to analyze all this stuff.
Wow, that's great. Hey, can I ask you guys one more favor before you go?
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe in the upcoming weeks as you're driving around Mars, obviously we've all seen the pictures where the rovers leave the tracks in the sand. Would it be possible maybe just to kind of spell out Floss Weekly in nice big letters on the Mars sand there for us?
We try to sell this idea to the project, but it didn't really fly. We were thinking to have sponsors pay for our salaries. But unfortunately, that did not happen.
Yeah, maybe we could have done something more subtle. Maybe we could have just, engraved a sponsor's name on one of the little flanges on the rover solar panels or something like that. Yeah. And just kind of take a little microscopic image of it. We could actually, if we did that, the way that they put people's names on a grain of rice and that kind of deal, we could put a whole lot of sponsors on that and just take a single microscopic image and, have like Coke and Nike and whatever, a little swoosh and all that kind of stuff. We can make a whole lot of, we could solve all our funding problems that way, I think.
I could just see this Mars bars in particular, right there on the side of the flange, right there, just
absolutely.
A little Mars bar. Yeah, that'd be great. Great. Okay, guys, really, I'd love to, like I said, I'd love to stay and chat, but we got to move on to the next show. So
nice
really appreciate
you.
You guys coming out, man. This is great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow, Aaron, what an amazing conversation. I love the fact that we had mission critical Pearl. I'm excited. I was that's actually stunned me. You heard me. I couldn't talk after that. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was excited to hear him, as a Sun now Oracle employee, I was glad to hear that they were using some Sun hardware to make this thing work, especially that they're using a flash drive. What did he say? 256 megabyte flash drive on the rover. Flash is one of the products that I work with and represent. So it was really interesting. I think that's going to have to go in my next slide deck on Flash to say that, hey, the Mars rover is using Flash to capture and send data back to Earth. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. So, this is going to be a hard show to beat, but we do have some really great guests coming up. Let me tell you who's coming up. We've got Ryan Levengood coming up next week. He's one of the key developers on the Haiku operating system. Do you know anything about Haiku?
No.
Well, good. You'll have to tune in next week then.
Absolutely. I know what it is, but I've never really been involved with this. That'd be great.
And then following that, we've got Matt Ray of Xenos, which is a monitoring platform to make sure your systems are up and running. Are you familiar with Xenos?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They're at most of the Linux conventions. They do a lot of training and free training for people to use Xenos. So, yeah, that's actually I know quite a bit about that. Yep.
And I saw Matt at the Texas Linux Fest a couple weeks ago. I was down there. Down there for a lot of fun. And then coming up along that is Jonathan Simpson. He works with the PDPC, and you might know him better, or the PDPC better, as if you've ever used the IRC network called Freenode, because they provide that. So we got some really cool guests coming up. I'm going to be in New York City in a couple of days as we're taping this. I'll probably already have gone by then. But if you want to follow my travels, I'm actually on a cruise next week. So by the time you're actually listening to this, I'll actually be out at sea somewhere, which is a lot of fun. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Merlyn, MERLYN. Find out what the upcoming guests are going to be like and all that sort of stuff. Aaron, you have a Twitter handle?
Yeah, absolutely. Twitter.com/AaronNewcomb, all one word. You can also follow me on my website, thesourceshow.org, which is my video podcast, occasional video podcast, I should say. It's I'm so busy. It's taken me a long time to get episodes out, but you can go there and watch my latest episode where I show you how I use open source software all around my house.
That's really good. Well, thanks for being on this week's show, Aaron. I hope you'll be coming back soon again to chat with us. And to all our audience, I hope you'll be staying subscribed and listening to us. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.